Those fittings are for machine guns, I'm sure of it. And see these specs handwritten down there? That's for add-ons made from Kevlar and also bullet-resistant clear polymers. Protection and visibility. Kuga's guys took the industrial version and weaponized it. I ran the numbers on the armor, and it will create a protective shell that allows more than 250 degrees of visibility while keeping the driver safe from anything up to armor-piercing rounds. My guess is that they'll rig a double-capacity backpack, one side for batteries, the other for belt-fed ammunition. You put a fixer in one of those, and he can walk into any building and do an incredible amount of damage. With a minigun or a grenade launcher? Well, butter my buns and call me a biscuit, but that is some scary, scary stuff right up in there.
This is adapted to military, said Church. Did you find anything designed specifically for combat?
Oh, yes, said Doc. A lot of that. And it's pretty goddamn scary, too.
She produced another folder, and this one had schematics, pages of materials, analysis, and other data, and some glossy photos. Church picked one up and studied it. It showed a soldier wearing a series of complex braces around his legs, torso, and arms. There were wires and coaxial cables in bundles running from servos to battery packs.
This is based on the Onyx system,
he observed.
They developed the lower body exoskeletons to help combat soldiers carry or pull heavy loads.
They also reduce fatigue, said Doc, nodding. But see how it's been modified? It's been expanded out to support hips, lower and mid-back, shoulders and arms. The effect is, if their notations are correct, a 320% increase in physical strength coupled with far greater endurance. A soldier in that rig could do a 50-mile hike faster and with less energy drain than a regular soldier could hike 15 miles on the flat and carrying no battle rattle. We're talking enhanced endurance, especially over uneven terrain and inclines, better handling of heavy weapons, and it guides orthopedic alignment to help evenly distribute weight and maintain skeletal system alignment to avoid overstress and pressure injuries.
Church shuffled through the photos and paused on the last one. This showed the same basic exoskeleton, sheathed in sleek black armor that hid the vulnerable materials and kept the bundled cables from being a nuisance to the man in the suit. A notation in the corner indicated that this was a K-110 prototype, and below that the word, production, with a question mark.
This concerns me greatly, he said, setting the photo down and turning it around for them.
It should, said Doc.
Bug picked it up.
Yeah, this scares me too. Just the thought of our guys running into even one of these.
He didn't finish, but shivered, which was eloquent enough.
And, said Doc, there are two more things. We found four separate mentions of something called G-55. At first I thought it was another product line, but it seems to be part of some upcoming project or perhaps a location. Not really enough to go on, and it may be nothing. Does it mean anything to you, oh mighty sage?
It does not, said Church. What's the other thing?
Well, said Doc, all through the records there are references to something called AO. Again, no clue as to what it stands for, and there's little contextual help since it's usually just a reference like 4AO and AO parts list, like that. But it shows up in almost every document, mostly handwritten on printouts connected with the exosuits and other potential field combat tech.
AO. Mused Church. That's not particularly helpful.
I'll put Nikki on it.
Nikki Bloom ran the pattern recognition team within Bug's department.
Have to tell you, boys, said Doc, every time I see those two letters, it gives me a nasty little itch right between my shoulder blades. Like someone's out there in the tall grass lining me up nice and proper in the crosshairs.
I'm quite familiar with that feeling, said Church.
Are you getting that feeling now?
She asked.
I am.
With that, he stood and left the lab. Chapter 24. In Flight Over the South Atlantic. The cabin steward, a slim Genoese woman who was a bit older than the others in the flight crew, stood in the galley with the curtain drawn. Her fingers touched the crucifix beneath her uniform as she peeked out through a narrow gap in the blue cloth. The first-class passengers were mostly dozing. Beyond them, most of the overhead lights were off, though a few travelers had their faces lit by whatever screen they were watching. The big 250-seat Airbus A330's engines running on autopilot were a constant heavy drone that lulled most people to sleep. Midway along the aisle, there was a large service dog curled on the floor, partly under the seat, but occasionally leaning his big white head out to look up and down the walkway. Beside him was a blind man, older, heavy-set, wearing sunglasses with very dark lenses. He wore earbuds, but when the cabin steward passed by on her rounds, she noticed that the headphone cable wasn't plugged in. It merely dangled. When she leaned over and asked if he needed help finding the jack for the music, he turned to her and, she was positive, looked at her. That had been a very odd moment. Over the thousands of flights she'd worked since joining the Alitalia team, she'd encountered countless vision-impaired passengers. She could always tell whether they'd been born blind, had lost sight due to age or injury, or were merely legally blind. She did not think the man in seat JJ66 was blind at all. When he'd turned to her and raised his face, even though the glasses as well as the dimmed ambient light were too opaque to see his eyes, she could feel them. It was so unnerving. It wasn't merely that sensation of being watched. No, it was more of being seen. And seen all the way down to the skin, to the nerves and blood and bone. It was violative, invasive, and made her skin crawl. Now she watched the aisle, hoping no one near the man and dog needed her. And, as if hearing her thoughts, she saw the blind man lean out and look in her direction. Those black glasses against his pale skin, the touch of his perception, it was so dark. That was it, she realized with an abruptness that made cold sweat pop out of her skin over her heart. It was like the darkness outside the plane was looking at her through that blind man's eyes. She did not like that feeling, no, not one little bit. Her fingers pressed the crucifix against her skin. Chapter 25. World Away Shipping and Storage, the Port of Houston, Texas. Eve limped down the warehouse aisle flanked by Cain and Abel. The rest of the Righteous, her special cadre of elite fixers, were back at the pavilion in Washington State. These boys, though, had become her constant bodyguards, and they'd passed the intense background checks imposed on them by Daddy. She wished Rafael Santoro was there, but Daddy preferred to stay in Canada with Kuga. He was always so busy, and she missed him. "Miss Eve," called a voice, and a man's head and shoulders popped out from between two stacks of crates. "I think I found them," said the logistics supervisor.
"You think, or you have?"
she snapped back. It was the kind of thing Kuga said, putting people on the spot, making them jump.
Found the crates with the correct, markings," fumbled the supervisor. "We'll need to actually open them to see."
Eve went over to where he stood and peered at the labels stenciled on the heavy pine boxes. There were four, and each had AO/G-K, and then three smaller, narrower crates with AO/G-C. She tapped Kane.
"Open them up and let's look."
"Ma'am," said the fixer and jogged off, returning quickly with two long-handled crowbars and a smaller pinch bar. The supervisor got a forklift, and soon all the boxes were sitting in a row on the floor. Cain and Abel set to work opening the big crates, while the supervisor used the pinch bar on the smaller ones. The wood was green, and it cried out in protest as the long nails were pulled out. Once the lids were off and the packing straw tossed away, Eve peered inside to see a device that looked like a hunchbacked robot. She used a portable scanner to read the barcode on the back of the cowling, and a small light on her device flashed green. She repeated it with the three other units, all green.
"Those are good," she said. "Repack it."
The contents of the smaller crates took longer to inventory because there were many objects. Gallons of chemicals, large bottles of capsules, and mechanical devices wrapped in bubble paper. There was no way to hurry the job because the scanner was uplinked to Wi-Fi and sent the scan results directly to HK at the pavilion and Daddy in Canada. Tasks like this were tedious, but necessary, and Eve knew that it was part of her training to be an executive within the Kuga organization. Daddy was watching, and so was Kuga himself. Eve did not disappoint. She knew she was a different person from what she'd been when she and her late lover, Adam, had been recruited by Rafael Santoro. They had both been smart and dangerous, but Daddy had begun a process of refinement. Eve also knew that her emotional extremes since Adam's death had caused Daddy some embarrassment and a lot of concern. She'd very nearly gone too far, and that was a terrifying thought. More recently, she'd forced herself to be more controlled, less a victim of her own excesses. And so Daddy had begun gradually giving her more tasks, often mundane, things that anyone could do, and watched how she handled them. This project, the one they all called the American Operation, was big. It was high profile, and any mishandling at any level could be catastrophic. The fact that Daddy was allowing her to oversee this, well, maybe it wasn't such a nothing job after all, she mused. She just hoped she'd get a chance to play when everything began going to shit here in America. That would be worth the wait. That would be fun. And who knew? Maybe she'd get to shoot Joe Ledger in the process. Chapter 26. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. They sat together on a couch in Church's study, which was lined with books and hung with art. They had cups of coffee growing cold on a table, and slices of uneaten quiche neither had an appetite for. The speakers were turned low as Leonard Cohen sang soft, brooding songs about love and loss and the decline of the culture of insight. Church wore a dark blue robe, and Lilith's was red, a shade darker and more luxuriant than fresh blood. A fire spilled light and warmth into the room, but the shadows clinging to the corners were cold and resisted being chased completely away. Lilith was a tall woman with very pale skin, intensely dark eyes, and full red lips. Her glossy black hair fell around her shoulders, with tendrils reaching to the tops of her breasts. Like Church, her age was impossible to guess. They were both older than they looked. Sometimes, as with tonight, they each felt every one of their years, and every inch of their scars.
"He's back," she said.
It was the first thing either had said for 10 minutes. "He's back," agreed Church. They watched the fire.
"How?"
she asked. Church almost smiled. "Rhetorical question?"
"Only to a degree," said Lilith. "I thought after the Dogs of War case he would be gone."
"For good? Hardly."
"For a while, I meant. Longer than this."
Church touched her face, gently tracing the curve from high cheekbone to tapered chin. She was, inarguably, beautiful. But many people over the years had described her as looking cruel, unemotional, queenly in the ways history's more powerful queens sometimes look. Not at all a fairy tale princess. He loved those qualities about her. Lilith had never once compromised who she was or acted conciliatory to anyone, certainly never to a man. He was also aware that people used many of the same adjectives to describe him. Cold, cruel, aloof, strange. Fair enough. They were both strange, and their world was infinitely stranger than Scott Wilson or Doc Holliday or Joe Ledger knew. Lilith touched Church's face as she studied his eyes. The tinted glasses he usually wore were on a table in the other room. He did not wear them in private, certainly not when he invited this woman to see his unguarded expressions. She said,
"Do you fear him? You've never actually said."
"I fear what he can do," said Church after a long pause.
"That's an evasive answer."
"No," he said, "it's really not." She laughed and shook her head.
"Your people,"
she said, gesturing vaguely in the direction of the floor because the apartment was at the top of a castle and Rogue Team International was based in underground chambers many floors below.
"Think nothing scares you, that you are incapable of fear, above it."
"They believe what they want to believe. They believe what comforts them."
"Oh, and you do nothing at all to perpetuate those beliefs?"
Church shrugged. "It's useful to be calm when things are catching fire."
"They think you destroyed Nicodemus."
"I have never made that claim," said Church. Lilith smiled but let the topic go. Instead, she returned to an earlier point.
"Nicodemus is a monster."
"He is a disease," said Church. "He never really goes away, and if there is a vaccine for a parasite like him, then I will be the first customer for it." She picked up her coffee cup and sipped, winced because it was cold, then drank anyway. Her eyes flicked toward his.
"He's aligned himself with Kuga."
"Yes," said Church.
"We have to be careful. He delights in revenge."
"Yes."
"He likes to hurt," said Lilith. "I've already sent a coded message to Arclight. You should warn some of your people, and given that he's now tied to a criminal network with tentacles in governments, business, and social media, maybe there are people we should both contact."
"I will be making quite a number of calls," said Church. "Kuga has resources, but so do we. And we have friends we can call." She nodded.
"Some of our friends are no longer in the best position to defend themselves. Aunt Sally comes to mind."
Aunt Sally was the former chief of operations from the DMS days and before. Church had met her in Germany when she was a young but highly respected CIA field operator on loan to Interpol, doing elimination and cleanup against the Soviets and other groups. Aunt Sally had been Church's strong right hand for decades, but during the DMS's last case, she'd suffered a terrible stroke. Now she lived in a very upscale, very private nursing facility in Corfu, where Auntie would likely spend her last years. If she still had years left. Of all the people with whom Church worked closely, Auntie had been with him the longest. She'd known some of his secrets. Some. Not all. "And here I thought you couldn't stand her," he chided. Lilith gave a small shrug.
"There's no love lost between us, but she's family. We both know that family may dislike and even disown you until the chips are down, and then blood tells."
They sat and thought about that for a while. Blood tells. Church's daughter Circe was estranged from him, her choice. They had never been close, or rather, as soon as she knew what kind of things her father did for a living and to what lengths he would go to fight the never-ending war, she withdrew from him. He got to visit her and her husband, Rudy Sanchez, only because Rudy insisted that Church be allowed to see his grandson. But the visits were few, they were chilly, and Church always left more broken-hearted than he had been when he arrived. Church visited Aunt Sally's care facility 4 times as often as he got to see his grandson, a fact made even more painful because that facility was less than a 1/4 mile from where Circe and Rudy lived on the island of Corfu.
"Blood tells," he echoed.
Lilith gave him a sharp, penetrating look, then set her coffee cup down and pulled him to her for a kiss. Chapter 27. Hotel Biblos, 20 Avenue Paul Signac, Saint-Tropez, France. Michael Augustus Stafford lay poolside, splitting his attention between a flock of exceptionally lovely women sunbathing across from him, an email from his stockbroker, and news stories about a terrible terrorist attack at a sportswear factory in a small village in central Java. What a shame. Total loss of life. The reporters did not focus on the complete lack of cell phone photos or videos. Of course they didn't. Mr. Sunday and Rafael Santoro would make very sure of that. That deep in the third world, it was easy to buy off anyone who mattered. It made him happy that his employers were happy. It made his banker and his financial advisor happy, too, and his broker was all but coming in his pants. In all, a good week to be a bad guy. And that's how he saw himself. He had plenty of friends who wrapped themselves in cloaks of rationalizations ranging from "there's a sucker born every minute" to "they stood in the way of progress" and all the iterations in between, but that wasn't how he rolled. He knew exactly who and what he was, and Stafford liked that guy. Once, watching an interview with a movie actor who played a famous serial killer, the actor said, "No one is evil in their own minds. No one looks into a mirror and sees a villain. Villains, like everyone else, have to maintain a worldview that paints them as the good guy, or at least not a distinctly bad one." Stafford found that amusing as hell, and maybe it was true for some people in his line of work, but he thought on the whole it was naive. He was a murderer, a contract killer, an occasional trafficker in very young sex workers, and frequently in cahoots with terrorists. That made him a bad guy, and that was what he always wanted to be. He was not a product of a bad childhood. His folks were great. So were his 2 sisters and older brother. All of them fine people, gentle, supportive, fun. Nor was he bullied in school. He had no chemical imbalances, no brain tumors, and was not anywhere on the autism spectrum. He was pretty sure he wasn't even a sociopath, though perhaps an argument could be made. Nope. He was just a bad guy. A very good-looking, well-hung, and seriously rich bad guy. And that made him very, very happy. Chapter 28. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. The 4 members of Havoc Team were in a corner of the mess hall, Top and Bunny, Belle and Andrea. There were other people around, operators from the other teams, Bedlam and Chaos, scientists and lab techs, general staff. No one came and sat with the 4 remaining members of Havoc Team. No one even came over to chat. They knew. Everyone knew. Colonel Joe Ledger had gone off the reservation. That was the expression, and it carried with it a lot of weight, a lot of doubt and uncertainty, a lot of fear. Ledger was the cornerstone of the Field Operations Division. To everyone who worked for Mr. Church, Ledger was something of a mythological figure. He was the jovial party guy who was everybody's friend when the beer was flowing and the steaks sizzling. He was the operator you wanted coming when you'd been praying for the 7th Cavalry to ride over the hill. He was the guy people told stories about without having to exaggerate a single detail. He was a warrior who stood between the innocent and harm, preferring to take the shot meant for the good guys. He was the one who'd actually saved the world, time and again. And now, he was gone. Just gone. Andrea stared into the depths of a coffee cup as if it would suddenly become a magician's mirror.
Alligator balls, he murmured.
Many of Andrea's comments focused on the testicles of some animal, real or mythological, or those of various saints. Bunny grunted.
Why alligator balls?
Because it is, said Andrea.
Bunny thought about it, nodded, and went back to looking sick and stricken.
He will come back, said Belle.
It was not the first time she'd said this, and as before, the others nodded without any real optimism. Top Sims sipped his coffee, which was excellent, but winced as if it caused him physical pain. The wince had nothing to do with the coffee, and his friends knew it. He was in serious pain that had nothing to do with nerve endings or old injuries. Top was not taking this well. Bunny punched him lightly on the arm.
Not your fault, old man.
Maybe it's all our faults, farm boy, said Top.
How do you figure that?
Top shook his head.
We all knew the colonel was still too busted up from last Christmas. No way he should have been let back into the field. That's on us.
And were we supposed to stop him?
Asked Bell.
By any means necessary, said Top. Up to and including kneecapping him. Better a limp than him losing his shit and going rogue out in the world.
He is going after Rafael Santoro and Cougar, said Bell. Maybe this is a good thing.
Top turned slowly to look at her.
We are going after Santoro and Kuga. All of us. Field teams, everyone at the TOC, integrated sciences and computer sciences, the whole RTI machinery. That's what we're here for. The colonel is a force of nature, sure, and I'd walk through hell on Sunday for him. We all would, but he can't do this alone. Cannot and damn well should not.
Hoo-ah,
said Bunny softly.
We're the ones closest to him. And we let him down.
Top paused and gave another shake of his head.
I let him down. I told him to go out and get some air. That was on me. I should have put one of you with him.
No, said Bunny. That's bullshit.
If the colonel wanted to slip away, he'd have found a way even if we were babysitting him. This is Joe Ledger we're talking about. Now, you can secure that shit right now because it's not true. He wanted to go, and he went. If it wasn't on that island, then he'd have found a moment and gone.
Then we need to find him, farm boy. Instead of sitting here with our thumbs up our asses, instead of mounting a full-on hunt, what are we doing? You and me. We're flying all the way the hell to goddamned America for some goddamned undercover mission that might not be worth a goddamn thing.
Job's a job, said Bunny.
Colonel Ledger should be our job. We don't know where he is or what he's doing, but whatever he's up to, it's not good. This isn't him making sound decisions. That bomb on Christmas Eve blew out all his circuits, and you know it as well as I do. Best case scenario is he's in some bar, God knows where, drinking himself to death. Worst case scenario, well, you all saw what he did in Croatia. Those lab techs, then executing Mitrovic in cold blood while a man was unconscious and helpless. Find him. Find him in time? Shit. How?
Bug's looking, said Bunny.
Scott Wilson's looking. And you can bet Mr. Church has put out calls to everyone he knows. Arclide, Barrier, Sigma Force, Kingdom, SEAL Team 666, the whole damn network. Someone's going to find him.
If he wants to be found, said Bell. Only if he wants to be found.
They fell silent. A few moments later, Andrea repeated.
Alligator balls.
Yeah, agreed Bunny. Absolutely.
Chapter 29 O.R. Tambo International Airport, Kempton Park, Johannesburg, South Africa. The fat, old, blind man with the service dog deplaned with the rest of the passengers and headed to the men's room. Not the first one, or the second, but the third lavatory in the terminal. He loitered at the sink, washing his hands until everyone was gone, and then slipped quickly into a stall. More travelers came in, but if any of them took particular notice of a tall, middle-aged businessman with salt-and-pepper dark brown hair, bushy eyebrows, and a neat mustache, no comments were made. One exception was when a child in the terminal went to pet the man's seeing-eye dog. A young mother scolded him and then apologized to the dog's master.
"Quite all right,"
said the blind man. His accent was a local one, and the woman took her child away. The blind man and his dog went outside, caught a cab, and took it first to an electronics store, then to a pharmacy, a clothing store, and finally up to the Reef Hotel on Anderson Street in the Marshalltown area of the city. He paid the driver and tipped well enough to pay for the man's patience. Once settled into the room, the man showered and changed into new clothes. Then he sat on the edge of the bed and set up the new burner phone he'd bought. He made several short phone calls and then lay back on his bed and closed his eyes. The dog jumped up and sprawled next to him. They both fell asleep at once. They both dreamed. Both twitched and moaned softly as dreams took them down and took them deep. They woke when there was a discreet tap on the door. The man padded barefoot to the door, peered through the peephole, and then opened it. The dog stood on the other side of the door, ready. Always ready. The delivery man spoke only one word, a question.
Paladin?
Charlemagne, answered the man. The courier brought in two large suitcases, set them down, and left without comment. When the door was closed and locked, the man took the cases to the bed and opened them. He stood looking at the contents for a long time, at the equipment, the weapons, the sets of papers, and the laptop, each snugged into a special foam slot. Then he took a pillow from the bed, opened the closet door, crawled inside, pressed the pillow to his face, wrapped his arms around it, and screamed. He screamed for a very long time. The dog sat vigil outside, whining softly, the hairs on his back standing straight and stiff, his brown eyes filled with pain. Chapter 30 Freetech Research and Development Office, San Diego, California. Junie sat in her office, looking out at the California night. Starlight sparkled on the waves as they rolled onto the sand. Beyond that silver luminescence, the ocean became totally black, so intensely black that it seemed as if she were looking at nothing, just an empty vastness in the world. Or like looking into the deep darkness between stars. She turned away from the window, forcing herself not to look at that nothingness, afraid that it was some kind of omen. Her cell phone was on the desk, and she picked it up, but did not immediately make a call. After all, it was nearly dawn in Greece. Would anyone over there still be awake? She'd already tried to call Church, but it went to voicemail each time. Rudy and Circe had a young child, and Circe was having some complications with her pregnancy. Junie could not be heartless enough to wake them up. Bug? No, he hated talking on the phone at the best of times. And if Joe was on a mission, as she believed, then Top and Bunny wouldn't be taking calls. She didn't have Scott Wilson's cell number, nor did she have much of a relationship with the RTI chief of operations. Toys was gone. After her fainting spell, he'd lingered for hours playing nurse, but he was dead on his feet, and she finally called his driver, Mad Max, and had her take Toys home. Who did that leave? She could wait until it was morning in Greece and then call all of them. That was only a few hours away. Movement drew her eye, and she turned to see a bird land on the windowsill. It was a raven. Common to California, though she was more used to crows. The bird was about 2 feet from beak to tail feathers and looked like he'd been freshly rinsed in gleaming oil, black on black on black. The starlight traced the contours of his feathers and sparkled in the small black eyes. Junie touched a finger to the pain.
Nevermore,
she said, and immediately regretted the joke. It was the wrong word to use.
Pretty bird,
she said, trying to fix the moment and cancel any accidental jinx. Then she picked up the phone and punched in a number. It rang 5 times, and just when Junie expected it to go to voicemail, a woman answered.
Well, I guess I'm not the only night owl drinking too much coffee and burning the midnight oil,
said Doc Holliday.
How are you doing, Sugar Lumps?
Jane, said Junie, I'm just about going crazy here.
Doc sighed, long and heavy and dramatic.
Oh, honey, if you're calling in the hopes that this old gal has some news about your honey bunny, then I have to be the bad guy. I don't know where Joseph is, and that is the God's honest.
Is he alive?
Begged Junie.
I'd bet my whole stack of original Dolly Parton albums on vinyl he's alive. Is he safe?
There was a pause, and when Doc spoke again, there was much less of her country girl affectation.
If you were someone else, I'd spin a big pack of lies, but I know you have enough sawdust for the straight truth, Junie girl. The plain truth is that I don't know. We don't know. But that's also the nature of the job.
I know, but nothing.
Look, I shouldn't be telling you this, but Mr. Church can fire me if he wants to, which he won't. Joe's out in the field. And for reasons that he hasn't shared, he's gone off on his own. And before you ask, that is all I know.
Junie covered her mouth with her hand.
God,
she breathed. Outside the window, the raven opened his mouth and uttered a high, soft, sad cry. Chapter 31. Hotel Biblos, 20 Avenue Paul Signac, Saint-Tropez, France. Michael Augustus Stafford sprawled on the bed and watched her walk naked across the room. Angelique was tall, slender, beautifully made, with lean muscles and good curves, accentuated by skin that took an excellent, deep, honey tan. And that tan was flawless except for a tiny white triangle around her shaved crotch. Everything about her was luxuriant. Masses of curly dark hair that fell like smoke around her shoulders, green eyes filled with both questions and information. A smart woman who had the good genetic luck to also be exceptionally beautiful, even by the exacting standards of the south of France. Stafford studied her as she moved around the suite. She was as unself-conscious as a child, but wickedly aware. Every now and then she'd throw a tiny, knowing smile his way. She liked being watched.
This was a lovely oasis,
Angelique said as she bent to fish for a lacy thong that had somehow made its way under the foot of the bed. Very, he agreed. He was satiated, tired, and happy. He'd met the woman at Gaillot, a posh restaurant club on the Rue de 11 November 1918. They danced, dined, had a lot of very good drinks, and then went back to his hotel rather than hers because he was alone and she had a roommate. The fact that her roommate was also her fiancé did not seem to matter much to Angelique, and it didn't matter at all to Stafford. They'd made love on the bed, on the balcony, and in the shower, then napped for an hour and made love again. And it felt like that to him, making love, more so than merely having sex. Angelique was, he discovered to his delight, as much of a sensualist as he was. She liked all the little things. The slow process of discovering each other, the attention to small details of the landscape of their bodies. There was a mutual generosity, empathy, and creativity. Each of their 4 bouts of passion was on a different frequency, which resulted in a different kind of orgasm. When it became apparent that they both shared the dedication of sensualism, the whole evening had transformed from the potential of good sex between 2 healthy adults and instead achieved beauty. Her first orgasm had been a screaming frenzy, but the subsequent ones had grown quieter, more internal as she focused on small details instead of grand gestures or a gallop to the finish line. And there had been quiet moments of holding, of talking, and of a shared and companionable silence. He was very glad he wasn't on a job. He was very glad he wouldn't have to kill her. Stafford did not look like a killer, but that's what he was, and he knew that among the right kind of people, men and women whose judgment and opinions mattered, he was considered one of the very best killers alive. Several other people who would have been on that list were dead. He had crossed many names off himself, not as a vendetta or through an insecure need to be number one, but because they had been given to him as targets. Angelique was not a target. She was, for 5 delicious hours, his lover. She thought he was an investor who'd gotten rich trading currencies. The people who knew him back during his college days agreed that he looked like either a third baseman from one of the better teams or a tennis pro. Fit, but not in any overdeveloped way. He moved like an athlete, one of the fast kinds, a springy step and easy grace. And he smiled like a sports star, lots of white teeth, brown hair with natural blonde highlights, and a tan nearly as good as Angelique's. He was considering whether he had the stamina for another round when his cell phone buzzed. Stafford picked up the device, looked at the screen display, and got out of bed immediately.
"I have to take this," he said. "Business call."
Without waiting for an answer, he went into the bathroom, turned on the shower, and sat on the closed lid of the toilet. He used a cable to attach the cell to a tiny device no larger than a cigarette lighter. A small red light glowed, flickered, and then turned green, letting him know that the scrambler was engaged. It used a sophisticated 128-byte cyclical encryption that was virtually impossible to crack. The device was specifically designed to foil the mind reader computer system. Satisfied that his end of the call was secure, he cupped a hand over his other ear and spoke one word.
"Line?"
"Clear," said the caller.
"What is on your business agenda for today?"
It was the right phrase, and he recognized the voice. All the screen display had shown was a number he didn't know, a burner, a disposable phone. Very few people had his current cell number. Had the caller used any wording other than those 9 words, Stafford would have hung up and fled the hotel, leaving most of his possessions behind, along with Angelique's corpse. The fact that the right phrase was used told him he hadn't been compromised. However, it was not a phrase he particularly wanted to hear, nor did he want to hear it from this man, Kuga. It was hard as hell to tell him to go piss up a rope, but he gave it a try.
"I'm enjoying my vacation," he said,
meaning it, letting a bit of resentment flavor his tone. Kuga snorted.
"Yeah, well, life's a bitch, and then you die."
"Nice. You should put that on a coffee mug and sell it 30 years ago. Look, boss, I haven't had a full week off in 3 years.
3, he insisted.
"Years. And you promised me that my phone would not ring once until I checked back in. So tell me why I'm talking with you right now."
"Joe Ledger," said Kuga.
Stafford closed his eyes for a moment.
"Ah, of course," sighed Stafford. "I suppose this was inevitable."
"It's become necessary. He is doing considerable damage to our network."
"What kind of damage?"
"Do you remember Mislav Mitrovich?"
"What do you mean, do I remember? Of course I do."
Which was true enough. After Stafford and his small team handled the labor dispute in Java, the new staff he brought in to fill the sudden vacancies had all juiced up on a super eugeroic cocktail cooked up by Mitrovich's team of mad scientists. Even the laziest of them was now able to work 36-hour shifts without sleep.
"Did you know Mitrovich was dead?" asked Kuga.
Stafford sat up straight.
"What? How?"
"That's what I'm trying to tell you," said Kuga. "Ever since Java, you've been off the fucking radar. Ledger and his goon squad hit the island. Staff was wiped out, and we lost a shit ton of key research data for the next phase of the factory workers project. Unless we can get back up to speed, we stand to lose $20 billion in the next fiscal year because we might not be able to fill the orders that our friend Mr. Sunday is taking. $20 billion. That's billion with a B.
Holy shit.
Oh, there's more, said Kuga. That cocksucker hit Vanderveer in Johannesburg. Gerald Engelbrecht is dead, along with all 11 of his staff, and God only knows what Mitrovich and Engelbrecht might have told him before he put them down. We are in serious trouble here.
So put a team of fixers at every lab we have. Your boy Santoro has enough of them trained by now. More than enough. He could invade a small country. No, let me correct that. If he gives them all the special upgrades, he could invade a large country. I don't care how tough Ledger is. He can't duke it out with those next-gen fixers. Christ! Did you see the footage from Java? It was like the police station scene from The Terminator. Those boys went through the crowd like shit through a goose.
Kuga made a small sound of disgust and annoyance. Yeah, well, that spooky bastard Church and psycho Ledger have a habit of winning against high odds. Ask the Jacobies. Ask the seven goddamn kings.
You sound like you're afraid of them.
There was a beat. Be real careful in your choice of words, buddy boy.
My point, said Stafford, ignoring the implied threat, is that they're just a couple of guys, tough or not, scary or not, they're just guys. And the new group, that Rogue Team International, it's not even a tenth the size of the old DMS, and besides, they don't even have the protection of the U.S. government anymore. They're freelance busybodies.
Which is why I'm calling you, said Kuga, his tone harsh. I want you to go find Joe Ledger, and I want him dead, in a big way. Pieces all over the place. I want it to make the news. I want it to trend on Twitter. I want it so big, so ugly, and so outrageous that Eli Roth makes a movie about it.
I can do that, said Stafford.
Show me, said Kuga. I'm sending you a shit ton of data from our field analysis team and some notes Sunday put together specially for you. We think he's in Italy now, but he's likely to go to either Romania or Germany next. What we can't allow, and I cannot stress this enough, is for Ledger to go back to the United States. We're ramping up for the big play there, but there are a lot of moving pieces, and it's very delicate. I need Ledger off the board.
What if he's already in America?
Then pick up his trail. I've wired expense money to your account in the Seychelles. Kill him and anyone he even looks at over there.
You're really hot about this, said Stafford.
You're damn right. Kill that bastard Joe Ledger and I will quadruple your usual rate. Take out Church, too, and I'll wire transfer $500 million into your account.
Very funny.
I'm not joking, said Kuga, and the line went dead.
Chapter 32 Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Bug shoved a handful of Cheez-Its into his mouth and crunched loudly. The latest HER disc was playing on 12 high-end speakers, with the bass turned high enough to make the various laptops, external drives, monitors, and a complete set of Wakanda Funko Pop bobbleheads tremble. A row of alternating Red Bull and Monster cans was close at hand. The empties were in or near the blue recycling can. The door to his office was locked and the security system activated, ensuring that no one could walk in. Bug brushed orange crumbs from his fingers before placing his hands on the keyboard. He was invariably messy. With Joe Ledger missing in action and Rogue Team International engaged in the search for him and Santoro, there were very few actual field ops, even in the planning stages. That gave Bug time to play. The Kuga organization was vast. It was like an octopus with 1,000 tentacles that stretched across oceans, across borders, and into so many sections of world governments, the private research and development sector, and criminal organizations. Kuga was also rich enough to hire the very best black hat computer pirates. Some gray hats, too, and, Bug suspected,
some white hats who did some dirty work when no one was looking.
Two can play at that game, he said aloud.
They had the numbers and they had some radical tech. That was the challenge. Kuga not only hired some of the very best, he gave them money and other incentives to encourage innovative thinking. Bug was able to see some of this rippling across the entire internet. New software, reports of impossible intrusions into systems guaranteed to be unbeatable, all manner of cybercrimes. A lot of it appeared random, but Nikki Bloom, the head of the pattern search team, had already built a case to the contrary.
If it were just one or two, or even six or ten random big-profile hacks, I'd say it was just random,
Nikki had told him the other day.
But then there have been some serious intrusions to government computers, university labs at MIT and Princeton, and even a military base in Germany. Radically different targets when viewed from one perspective, but when you look closer and see how their cybersecurity was configured and how it was bypassed, well, it's obvious.
Obvious to Nikki or to Bug was not obvious to most. Even some of the members of the computer team needed some hand-holding through the explanation, as did Scott Wilson, who was more diplomat than operative at heart, despite some years pulling triggers for the SAS and MI6. Church, of course, grasped it at once. When that briefing had concluded, Church took Bug aside.
I think it's fair to say that Kuga has a bunch of real hitters on his bench, he said when they were alone.
He does, agreed Bug, and they're doing some damage. Weirdly, though, they're not doing a lot of measurable harm to what Nikki calls the true targets. Mind you, they could have left spyware, malware, and viruses inside Trojan horses that aren't easy to find unless they're activated. The real damage is kind of a smash-and-grab attitude toward the test targets, the ones they experiment on before hitting the true targets. Some of those groups were hit bad. Doctors Without Borders lost an entire year of Ebola field research. They removed dozens of key World Heritage sites from the UNESCO mainframes. They blanked out the donor emails and contact information for the World Food Program. You know, those guys who won the Nobel Prize a while ago. That's vandalism for vandalism's sake, because none of that helps Kuga sell weapons and crap on the black market. These assholes are doing it because they can. And the bigger asshole paying their bills probably thinks it's fun.
No argument, said Church. That vandalism is also hurting a lot of people.
Tell you the truth, boss, that really pisses me off.
Church had looked at him for a long moment.
Then perhaps you should direct that anger in useful directions.
What do you mean?
Church smiled, not a big smile, and certainly not a warm one.
I'm certain something will occur to you. Oh, and Bug?
Yeah?
Make it hurt.
Interlude 9. The Pavilion. Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington, 4 months ago. Eve sat on a chair and watched the nerd herd, her name for the technicians here at the Pavilion, finish their work on the fixer. The man, Spiro, was a volunteer, but they'd strapped him to a chair anyway, and the chair was bolted to the floor. Six armed guards stood around in a large circle, rifles in their hands, barrels pointed down, but ready to snap up if things went south, as they had several times before. The bloodstains were still there, somehow locked into the surface of the concrete floor. She oddly wondered why they didn't use poured linoleum for the floor. Much easier to clean. Adam had taught her that. And Daddy would have used a tarp. He was very neat and tidy, always was. He could cut someone to pieces and not get a drop on him. He wasn't like her. She liked getting bloody, but Eve understood that her appetites were not the same as Rafael Santoro's. He was not crazy, and Eve was absolutely certain she was. She liked being crazy. There were clinical names for it, but who cared? When she and Adam were working their way through the convention circuits before Daddy recruited them, she'd become aware that her mind was wired entirely differently from anyone else's.
Except Adams, of course. They were two sides of the same coin.
We're ready, HK,
said the tech, stepping back. Even with the test subject restrained and under guard, the technician was sweating heavily. Eve could smell the fierce stink on him.
Pussy,
she thought. Spiro did not look particularly threatening. He was fit, sure, but not particularly brawny. Pale skin that hadn't seen enough sun, buzz-cut black hair, lifeless brown eyes, and the beginnings of a beard. If she passed him on the street or in a club, she wouldn't give him a second look. And not even much of a first glance, either. But everyone in the room was terrified of him. Well, not of him. They were scared of what he would become. HK, in a pencil skirt and electric blue blouse, stood with a clipboard pressed to her chest as if it were a suit of armor. Her glasses were perched on her nose, and Eve saw a sheen of perspiration glistening on her forehead and upper lip. She wished she had popcorn.
Everyone on their marks,
said HK crisply. The six rifle barrels rose and pointed at the fixer in the chair.
Brian, you may begin.
The tech, Brian, nodded and walked over to a small portable computer console. Beside the console was a cart laden with a device whose name Eve could never quite remember. One of those long technical names. She'd nicknamed it the Juicer, and everyone else, even HK, picked that up. Thin tubes ran from the base of the juicer across the floor and up to IV ports in Spiro's wrists and throat. Brian bent over his computer, and for a few moments the only sounds in the room were the tappity-tap-tap of his fingers on the keys and the test subject's labored breathing. Then something went click inside the machine, and Eve saw liquid follow through the tubes. Two lines were clear. Two were a pale amber. Spiro's eyes clicked toward the tubes, and his fingers gripped the arms of the chair. Eve saw his muscles tighten as he braced for whatever was coming.
This will work,
said Brian.
Oh, it had better,
said HK coldly.
You made a lot of promises, and I passed them up the line. We will all be disappointed if anything goes wrong. Again.
Spiro was sweating worse than Brian now, though the tech had gone gray-pale. Then the fluids reached the IV ports and entered Spiro's bloodstream. For a moment, nothing happened.
Brian,
queried HK, a note of warning, even of threat in her voice.
Give it another second,
whispered the tech. Other scientists were grouped behind him, but since Brian began the process, they'd inched back, either afraid of Spiro or afraid to stand too close to Brian if this was another failure. The scream was so sudden, so loud and shocking that it seemed to punch Eve in the brain. Spiro didn't even have time to throw back his head. The scream just ripped its way out of his chest with such force that blood flecked the fixer's lips. The sound was so enormous that everyone shrank back. Even the guards flinched. Had they been less professional and had their fingers on their triggers rather than laid along the sides, Spiro would have been riddled with bullets. The scream rose and rose. Then it stopped. Spiro clamped his jaws shut as every muscle in his body went into a spasm of such tight rigidity that even his goggling eyes seemed to swell. His lips were curled back from bloody teeth, veins stood out everywhere, and Spiro's pale skin was flushed a dangerous purple red. Red veins whipsawed across the whites of his eyes.
"Talk to me, Brian,"
growled HK.
"I,"
he began, but then bent over the computer again, typing furiously. Then Eve heard his tap-taps slow.
Wait.
HK snapped her head around to look at him.
What?
Look, whispered Brian, pointing. HK turned back and stared. Spiro's color was fading from the violent flush to a paler, humaner tone. The veins still popped on his arms and neck, but now they looked like a bodybuilder's after some heavy sets. Nothing looked like it was going to explode, and the man was breathing.
panting, but not in a labored way. Eve thought there was a sense of exhilaration to it. His eyes were still strange, though, with the sclera now an even shade of scarlet.
"How are his vitals?" asked H.K.
"Leveling out," said Brian with a sense of wonder in his voice. "My God, H.K., he's leveling out."
Everyone stared. Eve even found herself leaning forward, her breath held, fists balled. H.K. took a tentative step forward, and one of the armed fixers moved up to stand beside her, rifle stock tucked into his shoulder.
"I got you, H.K.," he said quietly, though clearly loudly enough for Spiro to hear, if he could hear.
The last test subject had stroked out by this point, and the one before that kept screaming and screaming until something in his heart ruptured. A valve, Eve thought. H.K. spoke very calmly and slowly.
"Spiro,"
she said.
"Can you hear me?"
The fixer blinked several times and looked momentarily confused, then he gave a single, jerky nod.
"Do you know who I am?"
Spiro licked his lips, either unaware of the salty blood on his lips or past the point of caring.
Yes.
"That's good,"
she said.
"That's very good. Tell me your name. Can you do that?"
The confused expression came and went, came and went. His lips formed the words several times before he finally managed to put sound to them.
"Spiro. Spiro Frangopoulos."
It began as a gasp, but firmed up quickly. He repeated his name several times, nodding as if it were a returning memory.
"And who am I?"
"You're H.K.,"
he said immediately.
"You're the boss lady."
"Excellent,"
said H.K., throwing a radiant smile in Brian's direction.
"Now, Spiro, tell me what it is we're doing. Tell me what you volunteered for."
"I..."
Spiro paused and licked his lips.
I'm...
"Go on. Say it."
Spiro took a big breath.
"I'm a god,"
he said.
"Yes,"
said H.K. Eve jumped to her feet and ran over to the fixer.
"No, wait,"
cried H.K., but it was too late. Eve began unbuckling the straps that held Spiro in place. When one proved resistant, she whipped a knife from the sheath on her left thigh and slashed the straps. It did not matter to her, or to Spiro, it seemed, that the blade sliced into him too. The fixers with the rifles threw worried, questioning looks at H.K., but she held up a hand, telling them to wait. Eve cut the last of the straps, and then viciously jerked the IV tubes from Spiro's veins. He began to slide out of the chair, but Eve grabbed him and pulled him forward and up, making him stand. He held on to her, swaying dangerously for a moment, but then mastered his balance. Eve looked up into his blazing red eyes.
"Say it,"
she growled.
"Say it again. Say it."
He towered over her, his body swollen and immensely powerful, his hands on her shoulders, inches from her throat. His fingers twitched and pressed into her skin, but Eve didn't care.
"Say it again,"
she snarled.
"I'm a god,"
declared Spiro. And Eve pulled his head down and kissed him. Chapter 33. Van der Weever Biomedical Associates, Johannesburg, South Africa. His name was Dr. Gerald Engelbrecht, and he lay dying in darkness. It startled him. He spent so much of his life studying the phenomenon of human mortality, but had never really considered his own. He was aware that he had lived 42 years, many of them good years, and expected to live at least as long yet, then he would be gone. He had no will, no living trust, no thoughts about how he might die, heart attack, cancer, something natural, something distant. Now, Engelbrecht was abundantly aware of the concept of personal mortality. Nothing else was as real or as present to him. Not the lab he'd spent 8 years designing, building, running, not his work, which had been everything to him. Biomechanical engineering, biomedical implants, micro-miniaturization, and the fascinating related science. Not the money in his offshore accounts in the Seychelles. Not the bonuses that fattened those accounts whenever his team made a breakthrough, as they had 5 times in the last 2 years. Not even his wife and grown twin daughters. None of that mattered. All of it was at a distance now. Blurred, as if behind frosted glass. All that mattered now was that he was dying, that he could die, that death would come looking for him. Not with some discovered malignancy in colon or prostate in his golden years, not a drunk driver punching through a red light 30 miles an hour above the posted speed limit, not sudden pain in his left arm on the 7th hole, 2 under par, and an easy line from his ball to the cup. Despite what he did for a living, and who he did it for, death of a violent and immediate kind was never something he ever considered, not for one moment, as something that could be focused on him, aimed at him. Now it was impossible to think of anything else. Engelbrecht was dying there in the darkness. He couldn't understand why it was so damned dark. There were fires burning in the lab. He could feel the heat. Pain was a monster that seemed to crouch on his chest, crushing the air from him, feeding on his pain and his astonishment. The heat of the fires was getting closer. The smoke was cloying, but when he coughed, the pain spiked into impossibility. Engelbrecht wanted to scream, but he didn't have the breath for it, so the pain stayed trapped in his chest, charring the walls of his lungs in its frustration. 2 words managed to sneak past the stricture, though, not as screams, but in a strangely conversational tone.
"I'm dying,"
he said, and a voice said, "That could change." It was a man's voice reaching him through the walls of his pain and the veils of utter blackness that clouded Engelbrecht's eyes. It was he, the killer, the one who smashed the world apart with his guns and knife and that dreadful white dog. He was still here and close, too.
I don't want to die, said Engelbrecht,
his voice still reasonable.
I'm not ready.
I don't care, said the killer. Was he closer now? Engelbrecht licked his lips.
Will you help me?
He knew it was a stupid question, but it came out anyway and in a different tone of voice, plaintive, but not in a good way, childish, almost wheedling. He had a vague desire to apologize. I asked you a question, said the killer. Clock's running out for you to answer.
I don't remember the question,
said Engelbrecht vaguely. Had he, in fact, been asked a question? If so, was it in this lifetime or some other distant incarnation? Perhaps in a dream? Or was this the dream, and soon he would wake up? He distantly wondered what dreams of violence and fire meant. I'll ask one last time, said the killer slowly. He had an American accent, but there was something odd about his voice. The timbre had a quality that Engelbrecht could not define. It felt somehow darker than it should, though he had no idea how such a thing was possible. 2 questions, really. Where is Kuga? Where is Santoro?
But I don't know where they are.
Are you lying to me?
No. I've never even met them. Everything goes through an intermediary, cried Engelbrecht. I have no idea where to find...
Who is the intermediary? Asked the killer. Lie to me and I'll know. Engelbrecht's mouth was so dry and the heat from the fires was so intense. Terror filled his soul, crowding out any chance he would ever think of lying to this man.
His name is Fong. Alexander Fong, he said hoarsely. Chinese, but from Italy, I think. His accent is Italian.
How do you contact him?
He contacts me.
No. There has to be a way to contact him if there is a problem. You're running out of time. Tell me right damn now.
Email, blurted Engelbrecht. It's in my sent messages on my phone.
What's your password? Engelbrecht told him. There was a silence filled by the sound of the fire devouring the room.
Please, croaked Engelbrecht. Will you help me? I don't want to burn.
But there was no answer from the man. Not a whisper, not a word, not even a growl from that white devil of a dog. And in his personal darkness, Dr. Gerald Engelbrecht burned. Chapter 34 Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Church was back in his apartment, but he was alone now. Lilith was gone, taking with her all that unique and complex energy, her grace, her insights, and her magic. Although theirs was a relationship that could never be normal by any metric, it mattered very deeply to him. It mattered to love and be loved by someone who understood him. Someone of equal power, and who was a complete individual. Neither defined themselves by the other, nor needed approval or validation. The love, though, that mattered. It amused him to think that so many of the people who knew him, good and bad, enemies and allies, past and present, regarded Church as a cold and unemotional person, a machine, a freak. He'd switched the music to Miles Davis, Blue Moods. He'd met Aunt Sally at a jazz club in Berlin where Davis was test-driving the songs that would eventually make up that album. Charlie Mingus had invited Church to the date, and they'd sat together through three full sets. That was the night Aunt Sally walked into his life. She'd never been a particularly pretty woman, but her level of personal power and integrity made her beautiful. Now Auntie was old and dying, and Church endured. It was all the proof he ever needed that the world was mad. Even so, the memory of that night was a calm place for him to put his emotions. Even Mingus, the legendary angry man of jazz, had been in a mellow mood, even when between-set table conversation turned to politics. During the sets, of course, no one spoke. Church and Mingus shared the view that if you went to hear someone play, then you should be quiet and experience it. Church remembered another night at the Five Spot in New York, when Mingus had been so angry at a heckler that he picked up his bass, an instrument worth $20,000, and destroyed it in front of a shocked crowd. He opened his top desk drawer and removed a package of vanilla wafers, carefully opened the package, selected a cookie, took a small bite, and munched quietly. Then he began making calls. It was a long list, and not all the people he called were the ones he needed to warn. For some, it was easier to call one of his many friends in the industry, in various industries, to ask if they could help watchdog the innocent. With others, however, particularly those with whom he had once worked, it was more direct to call them. They had the skills to take care of themselves. However, Church told them to expect couriers who would deliver credit cards with no spending limits, passports in several different names, and other documents that would allow them to shelter in place or bolt and run. He was at that desk for hours, going through the papers recovered in Croatia, scrolling through decrypted computer files, seeing frequent mentions of AO, but never with enough context to give it meaning. So far, even Nicky Bloom couldn't find enough to build a supposition, and yet everything in him made him believe this was something of great importance. The feeling that he was not seeing the forest for the trees. Outside, the world sank into the deepest part of the night. Starlight painted everything, the forest, the other buildings, the beach, the moored boats, and the rolling waves.
It also traced the outlines of dozens of black birds huddled in the branches of the trees, hundreds of them, and of at least 8 species. Church had noticed them beginning to gather shortly after Christmas. Some were migratory birds that should long ago have flown south. It was Church's habit most mornings to go outside with a bag of bread and toss it around so the birds could eat. But that would be hours from now. The night birds were in their trees, pretending to sleep but not selling the lie. He could feel them watching. As he worked, Church wondered where Joe Ledger was at that moment. He had a general sense of location, but no specifics. Those details would be scraped off the ground in Ledger's wake. He wondered what was going on in Ledger's broken heart and in his furnace of a head. He wondered how much damage all this was doing to an already dangerously compromised individual. He wondered what the price tag would be when it was all over, and how big an amount he'd be adding to the deep debt already stacked against his own immortal soul. Chapter 35. Van der Weever Biomedical Associates, Johannesburg, South Africa. The man staggered away from the burning building. He tripped and fell twice. Again, and finally stopped trying and sank slowly to his knees. Everything in front of him was darkness. Everything behind him was hell itself. Long fingers of bright orange flame clawed at the sky, tearing apart the midnight clouds. The man knelt there, panting, gasping for clean air in a soiled world. A big white dog stood nearby, his coat speckled with blood, eyes bright, muscles trembling. All around them both, in every tree, the nightbirds watched with black and unreadable eyes. The man looked down at his hands and for a twisted moment thought he was wearing red gloves. But then the truth punched him in the face. In the heart. The blood-spattered dog came over slowly, cautiously, and stopped beside the man, then pushed at him with its muzzle as if urging him to get up. To run. The man shook his head and began furiously scrubbing at his hands, but one bloody hand could not clean the other. He caved slowly forward until his forehead touched the dirt.
God, he begged, help me.
But it was not a divine hand that pulled him up, forced him to stand, made him run when the banshee sirens filled the air. It was no clean hand at all that saved him. It was the colder hand of darkness, sure and steady and inexorable. The man and the dog vanished into that endless black of night. Where Nightbirds Fly, Part 3. Before you embark on a journey of revenge, dig 2 graves. Confucius. Life being what it is, one dreams of revenge. Paul Gauguin. Chapter 36. Free Tech Research and Development Office, San Diego, California. Junie Flynn did not expect the call to go through. It hadn't, the last dozen times she'd phoned, and it was becoming apparent to her that Mr. Church was dodging her calls. That annoyed her, partly because it seemed beneath the man's dignity, and partly because it was unkind. If it had been anyone but Church, she'd have thought he was being cowardly. But Church surprised her by answering on the third ring. Miss Flynn, he said, then corrected it. Junie. She didn't ask him how he was or what was new. This wasn't social, and she got straight to it.
Have you heard from Joe?
Junie.
I'm using the scrambler, she said.
My answer would be the same regardless, said Church. No. He has not been in touch.
It's been so long,
she said, trying to keep both heartbreak and fury from her voice, and aware that she was failing in both cases.
It's been